This is Ted Brower. Welcome to an edition of the Brower Report. I'm pleased to have Michael Barrett on with me today and my son, Austin Brower. I'll be introducing Michael Barrett in just a few moments. We're going to talk about some natural things that you can do for drugs and best drug treatment protocols. We're going to go into the details associated with these drugs that are killing so many people in the United States. We did a show on this just this past Sunday night on how bad the drugs are and what they've been doing and how it's personally affected me and my family in the last 2 weeks. And welcome to Wednesday, October the 21st, 2015. And we're excited to do a show today. And Austin, I think you wanted to ask me about that music that we were having on the beginning of the show, didn't you?
Yeah, where'd you get that soundtrack from for the intro?
That is from Last of the Mohicans. And that's one of my favorite movies of all time with Daniel Day-Lewis. And it kind of symbolizes the last of the freedom, you know, with British rule and the rebellion against England and France and all of the stuff that happened in the pre-Revolutionary War. And so I kind of like the theme song, and I really like the movie, so I decided to use that as the introduction music for the Brower Report. And we did that, you know, that must have been 7-8 months ago now we started the show. So I'm excited about the music. I've always enjoyed that movie. So we've got a lot of interesting stuff to talk about today. We've got a lot of really interesting things that are going on as far as the United States itself in general. And what we're going to focus on today is we're going to talk about what's happening in the U.S. when it comes to different types of drug abuse, including alcohol. And I want to read you a few things about this real quick. This is really important before I bring Mike on. Right now, we actually have more people dying from prescription drugs than all illegal drugs combined in the United States. People have a hard time believing that, but that's what's going on because of all these, literally the hundreds of thousands of people that are dying because of prescription drugs. And also we have the highest rate of illegal drug use on the entire planet here in the United States. According to the federal government, the number of heroin deaths in the United States has more than doubled since 2002. The number of heroin-related overdose deaths has risen 84% since 2010. And it's unbelievable this is actually happening in the United States. Right now, over 70 million Americans are using one type of mind-altering drug form or another. This would be Prozac or Zoloft and all the different types of tricyclic antidepressants that we have available to us right now. And children of the United States are three times more likely to be prescribed antidepressants than children in Europe. And it just goes on and on. In the United States today, prescription painkillers, I mentioned this earlier, kill more people than heroin and cocaine combined. And we have the highest rate, again, of illegal drug use on the entire planet. My guest today is a man that I met this past weekend at a minister's conference over in Tampa. He sat at the lunch table with us. His name is Michael Barrett. And, Mike, I'm going to bring you on right now, and tell me who you are, what you do, and give me some of your background real quick, Mike. And everybody, I love your accent because you're from Australia. Go ahead.
Yeah, great. Hi, Ted. So my name's Mike Barrett. I'm the CEO and founder of an organization called Transformation Ministries International, of which was birthed the signature program Transformations, which is sweeping across Australia at the moment. It's a 12-month live-in residential program. For all drug addicted, alcohol affected, all sorts of mental disorders, we pretty much take them all, because we've got a real holistic program that's able to deal with them. And we've been able to spread this out right across Australia, and we're hoping to do it in the US as well.
What is the premise of your program? You were telling me the other day at lunch that it's one of those things that you don't believe that just having somebody, you know, in an isolated environment and then turning back in on the street and because the recidivism rate's too high, you've been able to find a way that you can actually get people off drugs and keep them off drugs with over an 80% success rate. That's remarkable, Mike. That's why I wanted you on the show today. How are you doing this?
Right. Well, you know, we one of the things about you just mentioned, you know, prescription drugs and taking a pill and even isolating people, you know, taking them out, you're just dealing with the symptom of the problem. You're not really dealing with the root cause of the problems. And what we do is when we take people off drugs and alcohol and that, the drugs and the alcohol are just bad fruit on a bad tree, if you will. You know, we deal with the root. Once the root is changed, then the fruit changes. So we're a holistic program. We're working off the four main elements of recovery, which is bio, psycho, socio, and spiritual, or biological, social, psychological, and spiritual. And we've learned over time, and research has shown us that if you don't have those four elements in place, then you don't have the whole picture. And one of those other elements is going to let the person down. So this is why we have an 80% success rate. And those are real statistics. They were documented after a 10-year anniversary of our program, and we contacted all the alumni, the people that have finished our program, and 80% of them were not just clean, they were living really productive lives.
Well, that's incredible. And for those of you who don't know this, I'm going to mention this very briefly. We did a show, an entire show on this, it wasn't a whole show, about half an hour on this, on Sunday night, Austin and I did. My brother-in-law, Todd, age 35, basically Sharon's half, my wife's half-brother, that we've seen like three times in 20 years, was found last week in Orlando, Florida, with a heroin overdose. And so that's why I'm really focusing on this, on these few shows, because we just found out his funeral is going to be next week on Thursday. The body's already been cremated. It was pretty, the medical examiners were being very, very careful with, because they weren't sure if he had hepatitis or not. So of course they always do that with drug overdoses. So the sad part about all of this is that, you know, this has hit our family very, very close. And I'm not trying to air any dirty laundry. If you listen to the show that we did last week, I'll go into detail with it. I'll be back on the Hagman Show this Friday night, and I'll go into detail again with, you know, with Doug and with Joe as far as what happened to my brother-in-law, how he died, how I tried repeatedly to intervene, and how he tried repeatedly to try to correct these types of conditions with him, with his father, who's a full bird colonel, or was. He's retired now. He's 82 years old, and how I simply couldn't get anything through to him. And Mike, you said something to me at lunch that really, really struck a chord with me. You said that there's you have like a triangle when you have these types of conditions. You have, I think you called it the facilitator or the enabler, the victim, and the accuser. Right. Was that correct, or did I get those wrong?
It's a little different to that, but
no. Go ahead. You tell me. I wasn't taking any notes. Tell me exactly, because you have two different types of triangles in that. Go over that real quick with me, because I found that fascinating.
Right. There's the whole issue of codependency. What you've encountered in your family is a very common thing, where in actual fact, you know, the drug addict becomes the drug to the family. So the family is addicted to the addict, if you hear me. The family is, you know, when the addict is going well, then the family's going well. When the addict is going bad, then, you know, basically they've hit a downer, so they've got to get the addict going well again, you know. But it's just a vicious cycle. And then what it does is it takes you into different dysfunctional triangles that happen within any dysfunctional relationship. And these two triangles are simple. One triangle is a healthy triangle, the other triangle is a very unhealthy triangle, whereby each person is trying to get the power off the other person or to feed the other person. So the unhealthy triangle is that of victim, rescue. Well, I'll start from the top of the triangle. So let's say persecutor is at the top of the triangle, then rescue will be down the bottom left-hand corner, and then victim will be on the right-hand bottom corner. And so they go around these triangles, and that you know, so someone will be a victim. They'll be looking for a rescuer. They'll be looking for someone just to prop them up. They don't want to take any responsibility. And then there will be a persecutor. The persecutor might be the drugs. It might be the situation. It might be another family member or what have you. Anyway, the healthy triangle is where the victim steps into the student, where the rescuer steps into a role of a mediator rather than a rescuer. So they're empowering the victim to step out of the victim and step into the student. And then the teacher is up the top. So whatever that situation is that is seemingly persecuting the person, then that becomes their teacher, and they learn from that, and they change, and they adapt, and they grow, and they take responsibility.
Now, what does the persecutor become? Because, you know, the rescuer, I guess, is... One more time, tell me what those are again, because I'm writing them down this time.
Right. So the victim becomes the student.
Okay.
Okay. The rescuer becomes the mediator. And the persecutor becomes the teacher.
And the persecutor becomes it. Okay, I've got it. Okay. Awesome. What do you think?
And if one person pulls out of that unhealthy triangle, just one person out of that triangle, whether it be the persecutor, the rescuer, the victim, the one person pulls out, they'll pull the rest of them out with them.
In a good way or a bad way?
Well, there's often some ripples before it comes good, you know? Because the person who pulls out of the unhealthy triangle, it disrupts the whole process of everything. So if one family member becomes healthy and steps out of the triangle, then all the others are just going to be, they're not going to know what's happened, and it's going to cause a whole disruption and a rippling effect, and they'll either step out into that other triangle, or they might just create that unhealthy triangle again with someone else. So.
Well, you know, what's interesting to me is I had tried and tried and tried to talk to the colonel about this, I mean, literally dozens of times, if not hundreds of times, and over the past 25, 30 years, and he couldn't do it. He was the facilitator. He was the one that was the enabler to Todd. He was the one who was giving him the money for the drugs.
Right. He was the rescuer, and you were the persecutor.
Correct. So he was basically, and what you said something else that was really interesting too. You know, Stan was really proud of Todd because Todd had a real high IQ, and he was always bragging about Todd, and he was always trying to keep Todd, like you said, you know, at an elevated point, almost as though he was getting high on the relationship with Todd when Todd was doing well. And so he did everything he could to maintain Todd in that well condition, including giving him money for drugs. Why does that happen, Mike?
Well, there's a couple of things. On the lower end of the scale, it's the shame that the father feels about not being a good enough parent. So he can't admit that somewhere, somehow, he's failed as a parent. Now, whether that's true or not, that's irrelevant. That's what he feels. So he's trying to cover that shame, and he's trying to prop the addict up, and look, so long as you make me look good, then I'm going to feel good about myself. So long as you're doing good, then we're all doing good. And he would get a high off that. It would be like, when he's doing well, we're all doing well, this is great. And just like a drug addict, when they come down off their high and they need another fix, that's like when he doesn't do well and he's off the rails and everything. All of a sudden, the father-in-law he needs his fix, so he's got to prop it back up again.
Well, Austin, do you have any comments you want to make about this? You know, you knew Todd relatively well, not really well. You only met him a few times your whole life. But have you seen this type of codependency with other people using drugs when you were in college or when people that you knew before you got saved? I mean, this is so prevalent in our society now that it's really kind of awful because so many people are on these types of drugs. And now the heroin and the cocaine and the marijuana even has gotten so much stronger. You were saying something to me yesterday, Austin. Tell me what you said about what they're doing now as far as genetically engineering the marijuana.
Yeah, well, I was discussing about a research article a while back how a lot of people discussed cannabis back in the 70s. Generally, most top-grade cannabis back then had a THC content of low teens, 12%. Some of the strands now, with a lot of the genetic engineering, all the way up to the low 30%, causing the cannabis much stronger than it used to ever be. One thing I was curious about that I was going to ask Michael is, you know, obviously, Todd had a very serious opiate addiction, you know, with heroin, anything, OxyContin, you know, morphine, heroin. What do you guys use as far as in your program for really strong opiate withdrawals? Do you guys use methadone or do you use something more natural?
You know, we don't use methadone simply because of the addictive factor of methadone. And methadone's a terrible drug. It's harder to withdraw off methadone than it is off heroin.
Wow, I didn't know that. I had to do a research case study in my undergraduate degree at a methadone clinic, and it was definitely pretty interesting to see everybody there. So do you guys use more of a natural approach, obviously?
Yeah, right. So we will use you know, different vitamins and everything. At the very worst case of scenario withdrawals, we'll give them like 1 5-milligram Valium to go to sleep, but that's it. And that's only for a couple of days, and then they're completely cold turkey.
Oh, wow. Okay.
But Mike, if they're a serious heroin addict, how do you avoid all of those horrible physiological symptoms? I mean, I've actually heard that people have actually come off heroin and died from not getting the fix. How do you ameliorate that? How do you prevent that?
Well, we have doctors, we have general practitioners, doctors on call that will monitor everything, but generally, what you've heard about heroin withdrawals is a little over-exaggerated, and it's a little bit Hollywoodized, you know? Heroin withdrawal is probably... You can equate the withdrawals to be like a really bad flu, you know? Like a really bad cold that you get, and you get aches and pains through your body, and like flu-like symptoms, and a bit of sleeplessness and a bit of anxiety. But the real killer is benzodiazepine and alcohol withdrawals. Benzodiazepine is your prescription tranquilizers and barbiturates, and when people, generally that goes with alcohol abuse, so when an alcoholic, the alcohol's not working for them anymore, they will mix it with tranquilizers. Anyway, there's been far more deaths off those withdrawals than there has ever been off heroin withdrawals.
The benzos, those would be something like Xanax here in the States, correct?
Right, yep.
Okay.
You know what's funny, Mike, because I've talked to so many people that have been on Xanax and other types of drugs like that, and they say it's almost impossible once you really get addicted to that to come off of it. What's the best way to get them off those?
Well, you've got to be very careful, because if you go cold turkey off those, they have seizures and they can die.
I had no idea.
The thing about the benzos is that they get stored in the fat cells. The drug gets stored in the fat cells for 3 months after the person, you know, gets off it.
Wow.
So their body continually releases it to them, even after they're off
of it. Right. So it's got to be a gradual thing. And you gradually, like any antidepressants, antipsychotics, any of those drugs, you have to just gradually take them off it. Otherwise, the side effects can be quite bad.
So what you're saying, if I understand this correctly, and I think that I do, that antidepressant use is more addictive and more difficult to get off of than heroin, and more dangerous.
Well, yeah, it can be. Yeah. Particularly if it's abused. Because you're dealing with the chemistry set of the brain as well.
That's interesting. Now, Mike, what do you think about this whole exploding cannabis culture now and the legalization across a lot of the U.S.? Do you think cannabis leads to a lot more stronger drugs? Do you think it's a good thing with the legalization? What are your thoughts on that?
No, I think it's ridiculous. I think it's just the government's way of getting more money.
Yeah.
And they can tax it, and they can, you know, look, you legalize, I mean, obviously, criminalizing or making illegal a drug or making it legal makes no difference to the use of it. It doesn't. It was the same when they tried to prohibit alcohol, and that didn't work either. If you say it's illegal, it makes it more attractive. It's like wet paint, don't touch. What do they want to do? They want to go and touch it. So, you know, it's human nature to want to go after those things but you know, to decriminalize it makes no difference. It's just like, you know, all it does is make it more socially acceptable.
Do you consider marijuana, like so many of us have heard and I personally believe, is a gateway drug to more and more heavy drugs?
Oh, 100%. Absolutely. Marijuana is what most people start experimenting on. Now, the problem is now is with the strand of methamphetamine called ICE, where people are smoking it. You know, it's made the link now where people, you know, casual marijuana smokers, they might want to get a little bit more of a buzz, so they'll sprinkle methamphetamine on top and smoke it, and then that makes its way then to the glass pipe, which eventually makes its way to the needle. And there's never been a stronger link between your recreational marijuana user or your experimental marijuana user to a hardcore mainline intravenous user.
Wow. Well, you know, folks don't realize that the number one commodity in the world is oil. Number two is natural gas. Number three is heroin. It's that big of an industry globally. and almost all of the marijuana and all the things that are being raised in South America, but almost all of the poppy fields and the heroin is coming out of Afghanistan now. What's going on in Afghanistan? Are you familiar with any of that, Mike, or is that something that you're not used to or you haven't read about?
Well, you know, I've heard a little, you know, and I haven't done enough research on it, but one thing I do know is that the best heroin comes out of Afghanistan. There's no doubt about it. All of our clients, they talk about the Afghan smack.
And how much is this? How much does this stuff cost, Mike? I mean, they said they have a bumper crop of poppies, a bumper crop of heroin this year in Afghanistan. The price has really plummeted. I mean, more and more people are getting addicted because it's actually affordable. How much does a hit of this stuff cost, and how many hits do you have to take before you're addicted to it?
Well, it's an interesting question, and there's no easy answer for that because it's like how long is a piece of string? It depends on your makeup and how much you need, and also you know, the main. It's like if every drug addict was given a little black book about drugs and it told you about this thing called tolerance, you know, that you're going to need more and more of that same drug to get the same effect. So you might start off on like 20 bucks will just get you so high, and you'll be high for 3 or 4 hours. But then as you use it more frequently, your tolerance level goes up to the point where before you know it, you need like $400 or $500 worth to get the same effect.
Now, you were saying to me the other day at lunch, you were saying one thing I wanted to quote it, John, if I got this quote right. You said that basically the heroin addict is always chasing that first high.
Yeah, that's right. And every addict, for that matter, you know, when we have clients in our program, we ask them what is their drug of choice, you know, because you will have, you know, heroin users or meth users or whatever, but they'll have one. And what we call poly abusers that'll use a whole lot of different drugs, but they'll have one that's their favorite, you know. When that person took that drug for the first time, it was like fireworks went off in their mind and in their nervous system and in their body, where they got this euphoric feeling that blew their mind, you know. But that's like the first hit they ever got, and it's never the same after that. So they're always trying to chase that first hit. They're always trying to get back to that first hit. So they're trying to take more and more of the same drug, you know, or they're trying to mix drugs to try and get some, you know, some of that high back. But, after, you know, it's the first one that they're always trying to chase.
Now, Todd, when they found his body, they said there was cocaine and heroin at the scene, and he was mixing them together. Why do they do that?
Well, generally, if it's, you know, if it's a... There's a couple of reasons. Okay, so if someone is a heroin user, they're a heroin addict, they'll mix cocaine with it to get a higher buzz off the heroin. Like, in other words, the heroin is not working as well anymore. Maybe the purity's down a little bit, or maybe their tolerance is just so high. So they'll mix cocaine with it to get a higher buzz off the heroin. And it could work the other way, where a coke user is actually... They like the feeling of the cocaine, but because cocaine's a stimulant, their brain can't handle it, and their anxiety levels are too high, so they'll put some heroin with it to take the edge off it.
Are they functional if they're used to doing this? Because when we saw Todd about 3 years ago at his uncle's funeral, he seemed completely lucid, completely calm.
Right.
He seemed completely normal. I mean, are they able to achieve that even when they're addicts?
Well, most of the time, addicts, they need the drug actually to function, you know? They live to use, and they use to live. So from the time they wake up in the morning, they've got to get that hit just to function.
So basically, what happened is Stan told me, the colonel told me, he said that Todd had stopped using heroin for the last 6 months. He wasn't using any drugs at all. He was just hooked on a few painkillers. And then he went to Orlando, and he was mainlining heroin. And then when I spoke to the coroner's office, the man who was in charge of the investigation while I was at the scene, he told me that Todd had tracks all over his arms and legs, and he had never stopped using heroin. Can a heroin user just stop using heroin, Mike, and start using things like oxy pills, or does that not work?
Well, they might, but they'll end up going back to heroin. It's
all the
like
time.
If you have... yeah, I'm trying to think of American cars, but let's say you have a Bentley parked in the driveway, and then you have like a Chevy Impala parked in the driveway, and you got the keys to both, and you're trying to refrain from driving the Bentley, but you drive the Chevy around for a little while, but you've got the keys to both. It won't be long before you're driving the Bentley.
True. I'm sorry to laugh, but you're Austin and I are both car guys, so when you use an example like that, you're absolutely right. You may have a Mercedes in the driveway or a Chevy pickup truck, but sooner or later you'll be back in the Mercedes driving it. That's exactly right. That's funny. I don't mean funny enough. I'm not. Please forgive me, folks. I'm not trying to be sacrilegious or making fun of all this. This has been a horrible thing for my family to deal with, but that's just a funny example that Mike would use that. Now, overall drug usage, what's the absolute worst thing to get addicted to? Is it the psychiatric drugs, or is it the heroin?
Well, I would have to say right now, with the intensity and the strand of what's available, I would have to say methamphetamine right now. It's sweeping the world.
So meth is the worst.
I would say, yeah. Because you're, like on heroin, if you take too much, you're going to go to sleep. Or you might overdose. Yeah, okay, you might overdose, and then the ambulance comes along and pumps you full of adrenaline and counteracts the, you know, or you might die from a heroin overdose. But generally, you know, with methamphetamine, people are losing their minds. You know, they're having psychotic episodes. In Australia at the moment, methamphetamine is an absolute epidemic, and I'm getting interviewed all the time about what they call the ICE epidemic. And ambulance paramedics, they're just pulling their hair out because they're getting called out to situations where the police can't contain them, and it takes five police officers to hold down one meth addict because they're just, it's almost like they've got supernatural strength, and you know, they're getting hold of firearms and you know, shooting their whole family. And we had one guy in our program that was a meth addict. He'd taken meth for the second time. He was 18 years old, and when he was coming down off the meth, voices in his head told him to stab the family dog 15 times. We had another guy who'd come in on meth, and he'd actually, for whatever reason, the voices in his head told him to shave, you know, forgive the graphicness of this, but shave his scrotum with a potato peeler.
Oh, God. Okay,
hear a lot of the stuff as far as back in the day with, you know, the cocaine epidemic in the 80s and stuff, and that's a pretty strong stimulant, but you hear stories about, you know, executives, guys like that getting hooked on it and still being able to function. What makes the methamphetamine, because they're both heavy stimulants, what makes the methamphetamine so much more of an aggressive compound than just, you know, raw, pure cocaine?
Well, firstly, I would say that the drugs that are derived from a pure substance are not as bad as chemically lab-produced substances.
Okay.
Okay, so your cocaine, your heroin, I mean, they're all bad. Don't get me wrong. But they were derived, you know, cocaine comes from the coca plant. You've got, you know, heroin, obviously, from the opium poppy. You mentioned before about, you know, genetically enhanced marijuana. That's obviously worse than, you know, the original, you know, plant.
Right.
So whenever it's lab, it's the more man gets a hold of it in lab, you know, in chemical cocktails. So the thing about methamphetamine is when you have a shot of methamphetamine, it'll last like 5-6 hours. When you have some coke, it'll last like 20 minutes.
Okay.
And cocaine's so much more expensive than what methamphetamine is. So you can get a much longer, higher high from a, you know, less money, basically.
Now, is that why it causes so much brain damage, Mike? Because it's been in the brain so long, the body can't deal with it?
Right, yeah. The heart, the brain, the central nervous system, and that's why all of the all the mental institutions are full of people who have psychotic breaks coming off this stuff.
Now, as far as that much mental deterioration in the brain with excessive cocaine abuse, or is it much worse with the methamphetamine?
No, much worse with methamphetamine.
To the point where it can't even be compared? I mean, it's like 1% for the cocaine and 100% for the meth? Is it?
Yeah, pretty much. I mean, you remember in America when, you know, there was a cocaine problem, but then when crack cocaine came in,
right,
it became epidemic. It became 10 times worse.
I remember, yes.
You know, well, crack could be smoked, and, you know, like, and you know, you get smaller substance. Well, you know, it's been chemically modified again. Well, it's the same with methamphetamine. But, yeah, that as a stimulant alone, it just causes so many much more delusions, basically, you know, like delusional thinking. They have psychotic episodes. Psychosis generally manifests itself four ways, which is usually paranoid, grandiose, religious, and sexual. So sometimes you get all four in one. You know, we talk to meth heads coming off it, and they're in psychosis, and, you know, they think they're Jesus, and they had sex with Mary, and the FBI is after them, you know.
And they really believe it.
They 100% believe it. If you confront their reality, they'll get really aggressive because they're on a mission. They're always on a mission.
Wow. Now, we were talking to some paramedics the other day, and they said that used to be when someone had overdosed on heroin, they could give them a couple of shots of epinephrine or adrenaline, and they could pull them out of it. And now they're finding out that sometimes it doesn't even work because the heroin is so pure and so strong. Have you run into that too?
Yeah, well, not so much in Australia, but I would say, yeah, from what I've heard and researched, that heroin is becoming much purer, and the amount of heroin that's coming into the United States is phenomenal. So
now, well, that's yeah, running through the CIA, through Langley. Through Langley, right, and through Andrews Air Force Base out of Afghanistan. I mean, we all know that. If you want to read the book Operation Gladio, it goes into detail on how that happened and what happened after World War II and how it all got started. What a mess.
The problem is
now there's so much money going into black ops from all of this that try to get rid of it, you're really going to put yourself on the line as far as getting yourself shot or assassinated. Well, if you start blowing the whistle on all this stuff, and the guys who try to do that, they just kind of get real quiet after a few months. You don't ever hear about them anymore, and it's just kind of sad, actually. Now, let me read you a couple of things that are interesting. This is out of an article, and it said they were actually doing what was happening in the United States and the breakdown of the society in our country, and it says a moral collapse is eating away at the foundations of our society like cancer. If it continues to go unchecked, it will inevitably destroy America. And if we be honest with ourselves, we see this evidence of this moral collapse all around us. And then he goes on to ask these questions, and I want to ask if these are drug-related questions, because I know a lot of them are as far as the psychotropic drugs and the tricyclic antidepressants. He says, what would cause a high school kid to take two kitchen knives and go on a stabbing rampage through his school? What would cause a topless woman to ransack a McDonald's in St. Petersburg, Florida? What would cause two 18-year-old boys to beat a 30-year mentally disabled man to death with a baseball bat just so they could get his Xbox? What would cause a new father to put his 6-week-old daughter in a freezer to keep her from crying? A lot of people regard those kinds of stories as isolated incidences, but as you'll see below, they are actually representative of a much larger trend. As a society, we're decaying from the inside out, and we need to start facing the truth that if we're ever going to get things turned around, we have to realize what is going on, and we have to confront these truths and these research studies directly, and we need to try to make a change. What do we need to do as a nation? And do you think I think most of these are probably going to be meth-related and also the tricyclic antidepressants. I remember I talked to a lady when I was in practice many years ago, Mike, and she told me her I'm not going to tell you her name. She may still be alive, but let's call her Jane. Jane was not her name. She said that she started taking Prozac, and suddenly she had the overwhelming, compelling urge to put her grandbaby in the oven and cook him, to basically eat the child. And she said she just almost had to be restrained by her husband while she was taking this drug. Is it the meth? Is it the Prozac? Is it the tricyclic antidepressants? Is it the serotonin reuptake inhibitors? What's doing all this? The heroin? Heroin doesn't make you act like that, does it?
No, generally not, unless it's mixed with another drug. No, it's cyclotropic drugs. It's they've been banned in Australia basically, but I know the FDA here want to keep pushing them. Is that right?
No, it's ridiculous. There are over 40 million people taking the psychotropics right now. That's the best statistic we can get. And some studies say as high as 70 million people in the United States are
right.
taking
well,
it.
Right. Well, they've been banned in Australia now. They've come up with alternatives to, because they've realized, you know, the damage that it's causing, you know. But yeah, you're basically messing with the chemical set that God put in place. Now, you can really take this back to diet. You can take it back to everything. You can take it back to, you know, studies of the water that we're drinking. You know, the traces of chemicals that are in the water we're drinking and the food we're eating and you know what a poisonous substance sugar is and everything. But it's just getting worse and worse. Our whole fabric of society. We almost need to go back to Adam and Eve days. You know, if you know what I mean. To simplify things and eat organic food and get back to basics, and I think that's where a lot of the problem comes from.
Tell me about the vitamins and the diet and the sugar. Tell me how that affects these people and how it causes these conditions to get worse, or what they're trying to tell me what you think about all that, Mike, because I'd like to know.
Well, you know, it's crazy because we started out with in 1999, you know, just trying to help addicts, alcoholics, just homeless people, you know, anyone with any kind of you know, behavioral addiction or substance addiction, and we had a few ideas on how to do it and that, but we over the years through research and development and everything, we realized that, like I said before, it has to be a holistic approach. It has to be bio, psycho, socio, and spiritual. Now, we're talking about the biological side, that our bodies were made in a certain way to live a certain way. And we've just distorted all of that, you know. So, you know, I realized this one day early in the piece when we were counseling this guy, and he's like, you know, so we're doing psychotherapy on him, you know, like cognitive behavioral therapy. We're trying to help him through, and he said that, you know, he's having anxiety, he's having panic attacks and everything like that. And, you know, as we started to look into it more, it had to do with his diet. So we took him to a dietitian and got his diet sorted out, got him down, you know, like he was having like 5 cups of coffee a day. That's obviously not going to help. But just his whole diet, and he was eating too much sugar and everything, and we got it right back to basics, stripped it right back to really how God intended for him to live. And guess what? The anxiety had finished up, the panic attack stopped. So it wasn't necessarily psychological. It wasn't necessarily emotional. It was more actually biological.
You know, it's interesting. Cecilia Rosenfeld, she was a medical doctor. She wrote an article years and years ago. She said that one of the primary causes of marital discord with their husbands and wives that were coming in for psychiatric counseling was that they had a blood sugar imbalance, and that when they actually stabilized their blood sugar, that in many cases their crumbling marriages completely repaired themselves and they were better. People don't understand the importance of diet, the importance of B vitamins, the importance of omega-3 fats. And what we do is we have a newsletter we have at our website. It's called healthmasters.com. If everybody's listening today, they can sign up for the newsletter and they can learn about all this stuff, because I'm a biochemist trained at Florida State University. Everybody already knows that. You don't know that, Mike. That's why I mentioned it to you.
Wow.
And
wow.
I've learned over the years that if you don't have the right B vitamins, the right omega-3 fats, the right nutrients, the right iodine, for heaven's sakes, and you don't have these in high enough concentrations, that you start having deficiency symptoms. And in many cases, like especially with the B vitamins, these deficiency, the symptoms can look like a mental disorder. And that happened in the South when they were having a lot of B vitamin deficiencies, because they were eating a lot of corn, which was specifically deficient in certain B vitamins. And they started having all of these people running around who were having all these psychotic breaks. And I wrote a whole email on that months ago, or a couple of years ago. It's available on the website. You can read it. And so, yeah, I'm sure you found the same thing. Now, what specific cause are the lesions when these people take the meth? They start having these sores all over the body. What causes that, Mike? Do you have any idea? Because I haven't done any research on
that. Yeah, I want to touch on that. I just wanted to go back to your B vitamin. You know, it's very interesting because we did an experiment and a case study on 5 addicts of different drugs. That was an alcoholic, heroin addict, a meth addict, a marijuana addict. I forget what the other one was, but anyway, we did 5 people, and when they were detoxing, when they were withdrawing, we gave them vitamin B complex shots, right? A big super booster vitamin B shot. And we found with every single one of them, it reduced their withdrawals right down.
Wow. Well, I figured it'd do something, but I didn't know it would reduce their withdrawals like that.
100%, so yeah. And that's a real, that's a complex booster shot, you know, intramuscular booster shot. But it yeah, like, it was incredible. You know, they because, and they actually said they felt a little high from the vitamin B.
Well, yeah, so, because it would, if you were deficient, it would actually do that to your brain. It would make you have
right.
so many. Yeah, it would complete so many biochemical pathways. If you gave it to you from an injection standpoint, you were massively deficient, you would actually feel high because it gives you tremendous energy, makes you feel very, very good, especially if you get the methylated B vitamins that are much more absorbable.
And that's what happened. And then those five went back into the rehab, and they're telling all the others were trying to line up for their shots as well. But we didn't give it to them at that time. But
have you used omega-3 fats like cod liver oil or fish oil?
Yeah, we do. We give them fish oil tablets. They take them three tablets, three times a day, and that helps as well.
Okay, what are the supplements you use? Like a good multiple or D3? How about D3? The D is in dog 3.
We just use it's a Swiss vitamin, multivitamin. I'm not sure what the constituents are, but we had a vitamin company that donated it to us because of what we do. So.
Well, another good one you can try is vitamin D as in dog 3. If you mix it with K2, it doesn't prevent it. It helps to prevent the arterial calcification. But what's interesting, a lot of the studies have shown now, because vitamin D is the sunshine vitamin, and a lot of people have this disorder in the wintertime where they get very depressed because of lack of sunshine. It's actually from a lack of vitamin D3. And we have found a lot of our patients, when they get on vitamin D3 combined with iodine, and they basically take the B vitamins, the methylated B vitamins, they have a tremendous, tremendous energy surge. And a lot of people, Mike, they start taking drugs because they feel so bad. I know I've talked to construction workers before who've actually started taking meth because they want to be more productive and make more money and work faster and work harder on their jobs. And that's how a lot of them get addicted to it, because their energy levels are so bad because of their horrible diets. They want to go in and basically be more productive to maintain their jobs or get a raise, and they end up burning themselves out. So what causes the lesions? I'm sure that's some type of nutrient deficiency.
Yeah, so, it's nutrient deficiency in the skin and everything. The skin starts to deteriorate. It's dehydration because they don't drink enough water, and, their heart rate's accelerated and everything. But also because they start getting like itches, and they don't know when to stop scratching it.
So
they will just keep scratching it and scratching it and scratching it until it's basically bleeding, and then they'll move to another one and keep going. So that part of the use of meth, and the chemical composite, is that it causes itches as they start to come down off the drug, and then they start picking at sores. And they just keep picking at it. They don't know when to stop. It's like they're chewing gum, and then they're actually chewing on the side of their mouth, and they don't even realize they keep chewing it.
Tell me about the spiritual aspect. How do you handle them spiritually? I know you try to get them saved. What type of spiritual program do you put them on as far as getting balanced out?
Okay, so first of all, the spiritual component's right through our program. So, we're bio-psycho-socio. We have a case management, a whole social model around it. But the spiritual element is sown right through. But, the program was really birthed out of actually I'd come off drugs and I got saved. And I felt, I used to go to 12-step meetings, and I saw the 12 steps as a pathway to God. So I went to the Hare Krishnas. I used to, go down and have a free vegetarian meal with them and have a little dance with them, but it didn't really do much for me. And then I went to Buddhism, Buddhist temple, and I just couldn't get into that. And finally, a friend invited me to church, and I went to church, and I was standing up the back, and not really into it, certainly really critical and judgmental. But then one day I was standing there, and I felt, best way I could describe it, was like liquid love hit me from the top of my head down the soles of my feet. And now I tried everything. I tried every drug known to man, and this was better than any rush I'd ever had. You talk about chasing the first hit. Well, this was it. This was like, wow. So I decided, every drug addict, every alcoholic, every homeless person, every mental health person, everybody needed to experience this same stuff that I'd experienced. Now, I'd only been saved 2 minutes, so I didn't know how you got the stuff. How do you get this rush, this feeling? So I just put two and two together, and I worked out that when you play the church music, the stuff comes. So I started having meetings in my house. I bought a little CD from the church, and I put in my CD player. I started having meetings in my house, and I invited all these people around from different drug rehabs and the homeless and off the street. And one guy actually even paid a prostitute for an hour to come, and he paid her for the full hour and brought her to the meeting. And, you know, look, I just said, look, everyone shut your eyes and hold out your hands, and you'll experience this same stuff. I don't know what they thought they were coming for, a snort or something, smoke or something, but they got more than they bargained for. And when I opened my eyes, to my amazement, you know, I believed it but didn't believe it, everyone in the room was getting in touch with the same stuff as I was getting in touch with, and tears rolling down their face. And so that was my encounter that I passed that, and it's still the paramount, single biggest life-changing element of our program. You know, you have all the, you know, the mind stuff and everything, but when people come in and encounter the presence of a living God, you know, someone said to me once, if you've got a problem with your Ford, you take it back to the manufacturer, take it back to Ford, and they'll fix it. You take a drug addict back to his manufacturer, and he'll fix it. And in the presence of God, we've seen some phenomenal things take place.
Well, that's why you have an 80% success rate. Because you right. balance the person back out. You give them the nutrients they need. You give them the psychological counseling they need. You get them off the drugs. And you give them God. And then basically the Holy Spirit comes in them, and they get those things completed back in their bodies again. And they don't have that need for those drugs anymore. They don't have that.
That's right.
They know how they can get the same feeling and have the same energy
right.
without the use of the drugs. There's no point in using drugs anymore.
That's it. And it's on tap. They can get it, and it's free. And they don't you know, and they're going to get it all the time. And I think, you know, a lot of the problem with a lot of Christian programs is that they just focus on the Word, or they just focus on the Spirit, and they don't have the other elements which keep them, you know, so that they minimize their effects and their so I think it's because of our holistic program that we have that 80% success rate.
Mike, how can people find out more about you? I know you don't have a United States website set up yet. Give us your website for Australia, because that's easy enough to get through Google, or through basically they can just go right to your website. Go ahead.
Sure. Yeah, so it's www.transformation, no S on the end, just transformation.net.au.
One more time, please. One more time.
www.transformation.net.au.
Okay. Well, we've only got a couple of minutes left, Mike. I want you to do the whole show with me today. Anything else you want to add that we haven't talked about? Anything else you want to say? I mean, what else do you want to talk about? This is an international show, so we got a lot of listeners. So anything you want to say to the people to give them hope that are in a situation where they have families or loved ones? How do you deal with a family and loved ones? How do you approach a person who's using drugs and try to get them to listen, Mike? What's the most effective thing you found?
Well, you know, like what Jesus said, you will know the truth, and the truth shall set you free. And one of my greatest passions is to bring truth into a family that's in those triangles. You know what I mean? And they're just going round and round and round, and they're, you know, there's, and the drug addict is basically the ringleader of a circus, and they're just deflecting all the blame, and everything's going out, and they're manipulating the whole family. Our job is to help families and to help drug addicts, and predominantly to help churches as well, to get the same results that we're getting. So what we do, if you're a pastor out there, what we do is we partner with local churches. That's how we do it. It's like a franchise base where we go out and we help you to set up your very own branch of Transformations. To get real and lasting results with addicts. If you're a family out there that's struggling with a loved one that's addicted in that, we do interventions, you know, so we do family interventions, and at the moment we're flying all over Australia to do these interventions with addicts, so we can help you with that, and to break the person out of denial and get them into treatment. So
I mean, how do you do an intervention, Mike? How do you do that? Because that sounds intriguing to me. How do you get somebody to realize that they have a problem, they need help?
Right. So it's a whole formula. It's a whole nother thing that we do. But addict or alcoholic interventions is basically a surprise party for the addict or alcoholic. They don't know what's happening, and you have all the family and friends and loved ones confront the addict on their drug use in a very loving, caring environment, that where it pushes it to an ultimatum where the person either chooses treatment or their support needs to be cut off. So it really challenges the enablement. It cuts off that enablement. I educate the family that they're actually doing the best thing for the addict or alcoholic. And it's like we normally have a couple of meetings before the intervention, so it all goes smoothly. I will facilitate the intervention, then I'll do a debrief at the end. And it has a 90% success rate of getting people into treatment. 9 out of 10 people go into treatment, and even the 10th person, their using is not the same after they've had an intervention. It's like the truth has smacked them in the head. It's slid under all their defenses and got right into their heart, and they're using with a conscience now.
Now, what do you do for a person like my father-in-law, the colonel, who didn't do an intervention, who refused to accept what was going on with his son, and now the son is dead? How do you help them to get past this?
Well, that's a whole counseling thing. To help him, we'd have to sit down and deal with some of the things in him. You know, he'd have to realize that he's broke. For anyone to need to get help to be fixed, they need to realize they're broken to begin with. So if that shock has forced him to a place where he might reach out for help, then we would recommend counseling to sit through and deal with the grief, but also to confront and challenge some belief systems in him and some emotional deficits in him, to help him to become a whole person as well.
Mike, thank you so much for being my guest today. Everybody, if you've listened to this show today, please link it to your friends on iTunes. This is one of those shows that if you've got a family member who's involved in this type of behavior, this type of self-destructive behavior, you have to do something. You have to be proactive. My thanks to Mike Barrett. He's been phenomenal show. Went by so fast. Austin, thank you so much for being on with me again today. You guys are blessed. Mike, looking forward to it. Hope I can see you this week before you head back to Australia. And thanks again for being on the show today. We'll talk to you guys tomorrow. Sheila Zawitski tomorrow. Me on Hagman and Hagman Friday night.
Great.